And today I'm joined by Aaron Wood, an intellectual property expert and my ex-husband. So join us now.
Come with us on the Being Imperfectly Perfect journey, where Anna brings to you guests who have overcome challenges and often their own thoughts of self-doubt and criticism to accept who they are, allowing them to live the life they really want.
Hello and welcome. And today I have Aaron Wood with me, who is, I'm just going to give the full disclaimer now, actually, he is one of my ex-husbands. He's kind of like now chuckling in the background. We'll probably cover this. I wasn't going to actually say that until later, but I just thought, oh, sod it, I'll bring it right up now. Also, he is, bar being one of my ex-husbands, which in itself is, you know, a claim to fame, huh, right? He is one of the best trademark attorneys in the country, if not the best. So I wanted to bring him on today, mainly because, you know, a couple of different reasons, because he is incredible at what he does. But I know he has been through different things on his own journey to get to where he is now. So welcome, Aaron. I will let you actually explain kind of this rather than me just telling your story for you. So how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So I'm not sure if I'm given that I'm one of your ex-husbands, whether that's been good company or bad company, but there we go. So I am a trademark lawyer, so I help people protect their trademarks. And when they have disputes, I help them hopefully try and solve them. Yeah, I've been doing that now for about 23 years. And yes, been through quite a bit. Some of it you were with me. When it happened, some of it mm-hmm. was before and some of it was after. So mm-hmm. there we go.
So tell me a little bit more about, well, tell the listeners, because obviously I know, right, already, but tell the listeners about kind of where your journey started with the theme of being imperfectly perfect, because I find it really interesting how, you know, from kind of the start of your career, actually some of the stuff that happened you used as a fuel and fire to get you to where you are now, kind of to find all the odds, as it were. So talk to the listeners more about kind of your start of your career.
Okay, so I would say the legal profession is quite old-fashioned. There's a various, and certainly the area that I'm in, intellectual property, is very, very old-fashioned. There are lots of firms that are small. Certainly when I started in 2001, there were smaller partnerships. They were ran by the partners, so people who were potentially good at being lawyers or good at earning money for the firm, and on that basis it was assumed that they'd be good at running firms. When I joined the first firm, it's strange, I look back at it now and think, actually, it was a really, in some respects, it was a really well-run firm in some respects. In other ways, it was really, really toxic. And I saw that there were some parts of the firm that I thought just didn't really work. And I mean, that firm was one that definitely worked around very, very firm processes and systems and rigid ways of doing things, which, I mean, now I look at that and think, oh, actually, that's not a bad thing. It's really good to be systematic and efficient and all those things. It wasn't necessarily at the time what I thought was right. And they wanted to put you into certain boxes, which I didn't like. And I definitely thought that things could be done differently and that I wanted to do things a bit differently. But the first, so I went into my first role as a sort of just out of uni, and I had a 6-month probation period, got to the end of that 6-month probation period, thought I was doing okay, and got the, you know, the chat, can we come and have a chat with us? I didn't get kept on. The lawyer that was my line manager was about to retire, who was an older guy, he was just about to retire. He was lovely. The rest of the firm were not quite as lovely, and the person who would have been my boss if I'd been kept on effectively said to me, just leave the profession, you're not going to make it, which was pretty devastating at the time. It was pretty awful at the time, but thankfully the person who was my old outgoing boss said to me, no, just try, because I was in Birmingham, so he said, look, no, try your hand down in London, there's more firms there. There's a slightly different vibe down there. see how it goes. I'll give you a reference. And so I moved on. But I've kind of moved around firms quite a bit, which is something that a lot of people are quite reticent to do. Because mm-hmm. they think, oh, you know, if you get a lot of firms on your CV, that can look really bad. That was certainly the mindset 15, 20 years ago. I think now...
Really old school.
Yeah, I think now a lot more people think, oh, now, you know, there's talk now that a lot of... Is it Generation Z? Is that what it's classed as now? Generation Z.
I have no idea. I feel old.
Whichever it is. Whatever people coming out of uni are called now, whether it's Z or whatever, that there's a lot of talk that they tend to do shorter periods of time. They'll do a couple of years. They'll do it like a tour of duty, learn some skills, you know, work out whether or not the place they want to be has got the kind of people they want. And if it hasn't, they'll just go and they won't worry about it. I could say that I'm a trendsetter and I was doing that back before people thought that was something you should do. But yeah, moved on. Learned from firms that I worked at, didn't always like the places I worked at. And then there were some changes in my profession that meant you could get some extra skills, do some extra things. And I decided I wanted to do that. Again, the firm I was at the time was quite old fashioned and didn't really want me to do it because law firms are quite risk averse. I should say there are, without delving too far into the legal profession, you have solicitors, you have barristers, and then you have a couple of different other professions that aren't solicitors and they're not barristers, but they do legal things. And that's where I slot in. So this profession historically didn't do litigation. Mm-hmm. I then got the opportunity to do litigation. I said, great, let's do it. It's really useful. It'll be really helpful. Good money, interesting work. But because the partners who ran those kind of firms hadn't done litigation themselves, they didn't feel that they could take the risk on. And so I decided to leave. And I think that was about the time that I met you and I started my own firm at the time so that I could further that. Because I kind of concluded there wasn't going to be a firm that was going to let me go on and do that in the way I wanted to do it. So I started my own thing at that stage. And yeah, and I've just kind of done that kind of work now for coming up to 10 years, which is bizarre because a lot of firms are still thinking about how to get into that market and I've been doing it for 10 years. So it's weird.
Yeah. And I think like, because we kind of worked together within your company when you started that, I feel like I kind of pushed you a little bit because I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but
I think at the time, I thought that I didn't want it. It's risky because it's having your own firm, having your own business generally, it's really personal. So if you are going and talking to people trying to get work and they're saying no, and they say no to you, that can feel like a rejection of you as a person rather than the business proposition or what you're putting in front of them as a business offer. And so at the time I was working for a firm and I had no idea whether the clients that I had were really my clients and whether they'd follow me or whether they were really working with me because they wanted to work with the particular firm I was at. So it was a really big jump and you can't really make the plans on the basis of clients kind of half promising they'll come with you. Because it's really, to have that conversation with clients that go, I'm thinking of leaving, I'm thinking of starting my own thing, will you come if I do it? It's difficult because unless you think you've got enough work to come with you, you probably aren't going to do it because you're worried about income. And if you start telling clients you're going to do it and then you don't do it because other clients aren't going to come with you, you just look like a moron. So, I just took the leap I was lucky to get a couple of interesting bits of work at the beginning. And it's definitely been a roller coaster up and down, but I'm glad I did it. And now I think I'm now pretty much unemployable.
I think that can be really hard, can't it? When you've worked for yourself for a period of time, you become unemployable because you want freedom. You like freedom. There's different. I mean, I think everybody's different. I know for me, it's about freedom, but there's certain things that you come to almost like expect. And then you can't get that from a role. And I certainly think, I suppose, where I think things are going. I think I'm a little bit ahead of the curve. I think both of us are a little bit more ahead of the curve when it comes to stuff. And I certainly see a future whereby, and I think it's in 5 years, it's probably not in 5 years, it's more like 10 to 25 years. But this point where actually people are not employed in the same way that they are now, it's more of a contractor basis where people feel more fulfilled, because I think we are too old school. You work for 40 hours and you get paid this. People are not fulfilled by that. They don't feel that they can do all of the stuff they want to do in that time. They feel like they're selling their soul, I think, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. I mean, certainly in my industry, there's been a massive jump now from positions where you're just employees. And at the time, I mean, there's been slowly a growth of these firms where rather than being employed, you've just got a raft of people who are self-employed and you're paid a percentage of what you bill. And those have become more and more, they've become more and more popular with lawyers, because obviously if you're a medium to senior lawyer and you've got client contacts, you earn a lot more if you do it that way. So you're earning more. It's very much a case of if you've got the contacts and you look after them and you nurture them and you're good at what you do, you are rewarded more and you can introduce work and it, you know, all those kind of things. If you think you're just going to come in, do your 9 to 5, not develop yourself, not develop your clients, not build a business, then it's more obvious that you're in a difficult position. I think it always was the case that if you didn't have that, certainly in professional services, if you didn't have that, you'd get to a level and then that was it, because unless they could charge you out for more or you could magically find some more hours in the day, they couldn't earn more off you. And so they couldn't pay you more. So there was a ceiling. And I think the other thing is, with AI as well, people are going to become more efficient. There's going to be less requirement. Well, I saw something on this. Maybe less requirement for the admin. It sounds bad to say that. Support side of it, whatever you want to call it. Because if you can get the first draft done by AI and then you tidy it up, then theoretically you can be a lot more efficient. You need less headcount. But of course, the other side is, how easy is it for other people, for small players, to compete with big players? And then what matters? What matters? I only really got shown it properly a couple of months ago. And it's just crazy the stuff it can do.
Definitely.
And you kind of think, given how easy it is to create things, how do you create something that's got some value when somebody else could quite easily replicate it with AI? Where does your value come from? And I think you kind of get to the stage, it possibly comes from your personal brand and trust in you as a person. So it's all around what you've created in you as a brand. So if I was a celebrity right now, I would be thinking, how can I use my reputation, my brand, to leverage something bigger, because I can get AI or other systems to create stuff for me. Sorry, I've gone off track a little bit, but that's, you know, it is. It's that kind of bit where you kind of think, well, the world is definitely changing. And yeah, maybe the part of that is not being, having an employee mindset.
Yeah. And I think you're right, because I think, whereas maybe kind of 5 or 10 years ago, an employer versus an employee mindset was few and far between. And maybe it was longer than that. I mean, I don't know. I started my first business 18 years ago. It feels like a long time ago, but it felt like fewer people were in that position. Whereas now it feels like a lot more people are in if we call it an entrepreneurial mindset, yeah. I suppose.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, you see, if you're on TikTok and all these other places, you see people showing side hustles. And so people are used to thinking, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a business where I'm employed and I'll have that base salary for a while, but I'm actually going to, at home, I'm going to work on this side hustle and create something that's actually going to be for me rather than me putting more money into somebody else's pocket. And I think people are realizing that you can create your own business in a fairly straightforward way, and maybe that will fuel things. So, you know, it may well be that you look at it and say, well, that actually the best way of working is to have your own thing, come as a team, collaborate on a project. And then once that project's ended, off you all go, and maybe end up having some pretty honest conversations with people about what you need and why you need them. And I think so I'm still a consultant with a law firm at the moment, and having had my own thing, you then go in and you realize that having your own thing makes you, how do I put this, a little bit more, I don't want to say cutthroat, but realistic, where you kind of go, at the moment, this is what we need. Can you do this thing that we need? We possibly need it for this amount of time. At the end of this, if the business grows the way we want, we're going to need this thing. If when we get to that stage, we need this thing, do you want to do that thing? Because if you don't, your role is going to be dead because we've moved on. So you can stay in this role if you want and go somewhere else, and we can employ somebody else, or do it and grow into it if you want. But let's just have an honest conversation where we're realistic about what we actually want and how long we want it for, and find a deal that works for everybody, which is you kind of get a lot less precious about it. And
I think even with what you've just said, I think people can be really scared to have a real, just open and honest conversation. And I know we joked at the start, like, about you being my ex-husband and whatever. I mean, we've only recently divorced, haven't we, within the last couple of months. But I think people, you know, find that kind of weird that we are so amicable. And, you know, yeah, we have had times that we haven't been so amicable and we've kind of worked things out. But I think we're both people who come from the place of, okay, let's have that difficult conversation. Let's work it out. And I know sometimes I'm having like a temper tantrum and you are guiding me through that, which happens a lot because you've got your lawyer head on, as it were, and you're very calm and I'm like emotionally whatever. And that sometimes happens, you know. And I think it is about actually having the conversations, which you have to just put your big pants on and go, actually, for the greater good, let's just face it head on. Let's face it situation head on. Let's move on from there. Whereas I think a lot of people are scared to do that, scared of like how that might come across or what might happen off the back of it. And like you said, I think it's important to go, okay, is it going to work for both of us? If not, let's make an exit plan.
Yeah.
So exactly. We can do this in a really aligned way. All about alignment. I know our separation initially didn't happen. It did happen in an aligned way, and then it didn't happen in an aligned way, and then it, yeah. Anyway,
I think the end of a relationship is always difficult. I think that's true. And I think the reality is that you've got one life. So in a relationship, if the relationship is not giving you what you need, then get out, you know, see if you can solve it. If you can't, then get out, because as much as the other person's not going to be happy, then also not going to be, they're not going to have their best life being with somebody who isn't 100%. Fulfilled. So
exactly.
As painful as it might be in the short term, just get it done and let them go.
I think you're right. And I think even when you say relationships, that's all manner of relationships. I think people can think it's just intimate relationships or whatever, but it's actually any kind of relationship at all. You know, while you're kind of like doing something that you're, I suppose I talk a lot about, you know, is it a hell yes? If it's not a hell yes, then you're settling. And while you're settling, you're actually not serving you or that other person, because like you said, you're holding that person back from actually, you know, fulfilling maybe a different life.
Yeah. So, I think the thing about, I guess relationships are, how do I put it? Intimate relationships, I guess, are a particular one, but they're just the top end of it, where it's all about, I think, about feeling that there's something out there and feeling rejected. So I guess at the end of a relationship, the two fears, that you know, the sad bit is you feel rejected, and the fear bit is I'm not going to find somebody else, which is underneath it all. And the reality of it is, it's such a massive world, there is somebody else. And just because one person it's whatever is happening is not ideal for, see, I don't want to say it's just because someone's rejected you, just because what you've got is not the right relationship for one person, doesn't mean that it's not going to be right for somebody else. And that's the same in life. I mean, that's the same with business. It's the same in friendships. And I think there's so many people who put up with crap relationships with friends, with business people, where they just think, I can't say anything because if I say something and I try and put it right, they may go, well, that doesn't work for me, goodbye. And I think the answer, I mean, people talk about boundaries. I think you do have to have some idea of what is a boundary for you. And if somebody else's boundaries don't fit with yours, just, they've got a choice. They know your boundary. You stick to your boundaries. If they don't like it and they want to move on, but it doesn't work for them.
Yeah, I know. I think
it sounds harsh, but the truth of it is, as hard as it sounds, I think you end up being happier living within your boundaries than feeling that you've compromised your own values, your beliefs, your values, or that you've got this, or the other part, which is, I think, where you end up, which I see with a lot of friends, where they have a relationship which isn't, I think one of the things with dating is people go into the dating world and they often pretend to be the person that they think they need to be to get the person that they want.
Yeah.
Because they know what they want. So they'll pretend to be something they're not to get the person that, and then magically they get that person. However, the problem is at some point that mask is going to slip. And they're constantly in fear that goes, if that mask slips, what is that person then going to think of me? Are they going to reject me? And then you hear all these stories where someone goes, do you know what? The relationship was going so well. And then we moved in together. And you're like, yes, because anybody can act before. Exactly. And then suddenly the person goes, you're not the person I thought you were. No, because I spent the last 6 months until I asked you to move in with me, pretending to be somebody that I'm not.
Yeah, I think that's tough. And I think people can stay in relationships like way too long. And when I talk about kind of like our relationship and the fact that, and I openly say, even to my current other half, I openly say, you know, our relationship, you know, was, we didn't end things because it was shit. We kind of, you know, our relationship was good, right?
But well, it was a growth relationship. Oh yeah. I mean, it was a growth relationship. We were both growing. However, there comes a point when we diverge.
Exactly. You either grow together or you grow apart.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think to have that kind of the courage, and I know at the end I did some things that I wasn't particularly proud of. But at the end of the day, you know what I'm like, right? And I don't always say what I want directly. You are like much better at going, hey, let's just have this conversation. I don't want it.
No, I don't think I am.
I see you as better.
No, I definitely wasn't. And I think that was part of the issue, is that there were lots of things that I wasn't honest about, that I think if I had been more honest about things, this isn't a what if, but things would have been different. Whether they would have been better is another question, but they certainly would have been different. But no, I mean, at the time, obviously, things that were not ideal when we split were hurtful. But the reality is that I know with reflection why those things happened, because we're all just fulfilling certain needs in our life. And sometimes those play out in a way that isn't necessarily the perfect situation for the other person. But sometimes, God, without that, you know, I don't mean it in a rude sense, getting your needs met, but sometimes getting your emotional needs met means doing things that the other person doesn't like
or might trigger them, you know. And I think we were both, and I know we're delving in like to the relationship front, but I think this is like really important, because I think so many people are actually not honest with their partner. So they're pretending that stuff is okay when it's not, or they're pretending they want something when they don't want it, or they're pretending they don't want something that they do want. And I think that can cause so many problems.
Well, just not telling people that, this is what I'm like. This is a need. You know, they can put it in different, I mean, they wouldn't put it in this way. This is a need that I need to be, that I need meeting. You're not meeting my needs. Now you can have a choice. You can either know, and I can be honest and tell you this, and you can do something, and you can either do it in a direct way or in an indirect way. But if you don't, it's not a threat, but at some point this isn't going to work.
It's not going to work.
If I'm not getting what I need out of a relationship.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, this can, you know, the conversation we're having can sound very almost like too easy, matter of fact, like there's no emotion within it. But I think you have to remove the emotion from it, because our emotions can cloud what we're doing so much, because we feel bad or because we feel guilty or because of whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't understand. It's strange because I still wear, as you can see, I still wear the effectively what was my engagement ring when we got married. People find that strange. I don't find that strange. That is part of my life. And, you know, I think, you know, it's reason, season, life, isn't it? Sometimes we come together for a reason. Sometimes we come together for a season. Sometimes we come together for life. And I think a lot of people don't understand how we operate, or the conversations that we have, that we still talk, you know, we still talk quite regularly. And I don't think people, and our partners don't have a problem with that, because we're in relationships where there's no jealousy, there's no threats or jealousy. No. Exactly, 100%. And I think when you actually hide stuff, that's the problem.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I think the other part is, I mean, it does also convert into the business world as well. You know, if you've got clients and it's not working, then you also need to have a think about what, and same thing, as bad as it sounds, that, as you said, reason, season, life. You're going to have clients who, when you start a business, are great because they're cash, they're just business, and you need business. But as your business perhaps matures, you may get to a stage where you go, I haven't got enough time to do everything. And this client actually isn't a good alignment with me anymore, because I've moved on, my prices have moved on, and I've got this person that I feel really... they've been a great client to me from the start. However, I'm not doing them any favors, because I'm not giving them the time they need, because I'm not cherishing them, because they're not the kind of client I want anymore. I'm possibly more expensive than they can afford. They're struggling with the bills, whatever the thing is. You're getting to a stage where it's not serving anybody, and you'd be better off saying to them, I think, look, I'm beginning to feel I'm not serving you in the right way. And then let them move on and help
how
them
do we
transition.
Move on?
Yeah, transition. Yeah. But yeah.
I mean, but it's hard, isn't it? And I think as well, we can come from that place. I talk a lot in my work about the difference between coming from, well, making the decision from a place of abundance, or making the decision from a place of, well, abundance and that I am enough, or coming from the place of scarcity and lack and I'm not enough. And I think there's very different energy when you have that conversation.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think there's, I think, you know, with a, even having that conversation means you're coming from a different place. I mean, because, you know, the fact that they're still, the fact
and
that
it's liberating.
Yeah. I mean, because I guess for most people, by the time they get to that conversation, it's been building for a while. Both people know that it's not really working. Neither of you wants to start the conversation, but by the time you have it, both of you are relieved that the other person started it, and you can either resolve it or, and stay in a collaboration relationship, whatever you want to call it, or you can say, I think it's time to knock it on the head, whatever that is. But I think taking that pressure off is a really big thing, because there's enough things going on to not have the emotional load of having to deal with things that just don't fit. I mean, it sounds horrible. I mean, it sounds horrible to say that you're gonna sack somebody, whether it's a client, a friend, but you know, people have got people with friends. They go, oh God, this it's an awful friend. They're not the right friend. You know, they're such a bitch. Blah 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 blah. And you're like, well, why are you friends with this person then? Just if they're such a horrible person and you don't want to see them, and then you can't stand their Facebook updates, and you can't stand their this and their that, just don't involve yourself with them, and just let it drift away.
I think it's habit often, isn't it? It's a habit, and we're in the habit of either being with someone or doing a certain thing or whatever. And I know, like, kind of going back to your journey in particular, because, you know, part of your journey is actually of late you've lost a massive amount of weight. You've done made a lot of changes in your life. You're doing triathlons, you've done an Ironman, you've done all of this amazing stuff. outside of your career and within your career, you know, you are definitely leading the way in the intellectual property world. I know, however, you are someone who is very humble about that. You know, I feel like I tell everybody, I'm like, my ex-husband is like the best lawyer in the whole country, right? For everything. I think I feel biased. You're ahead of the game, you know. And it's hard to also sell yourself, like you said, especially when you're a lawyer. You can't be in the position of selling yourself. We were talking about this the other day, weren't we?
You know, in reality, it works much better if you're going to a pitch or you're in that sort of situation where you've got a client, a colleague, something like that, who just does the talking, you know, like you just did. I couldn't ever say that about myself, because to be the first thing people are going to say is, what an absolute dickhead that he's saying that.
Pretty much.
So, yeah, exactly. Maybe it's a cultural thing. Maybe it's an English thing that you just don't.
Well, the Americans don't have a problem with it as much. Well, I don't know. I have been, you know, in an American firm with Tony Robbins. And I think, you know, I come across in the UK as someone who's confident. I was like, I felt not confident at all in the Tony Robbins world, because it is standard, isn't it? That you basically say, I am amazing.
Yeah. If I can't self-promote myself, no one's going to promote me. So, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't know.
Very but, yeah. English, isn't it? Very English. Oh, I can't say that.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think it is weird, because I'm now getting to a stage where people are looking to me for things. And I kind of think,
you don't see it, they always have. Right. They've been, you know, 100, and right. I can tell the look on your face, okay. But yeah, oh, you struggle with
this. I'm trying to move on. But yeah, but I mean, I think the, I think it is a difficult thing to get used to. But I guess the thing which has been tricky, which I think you just have to get past, or have had to do, is, it's that phrase that everyone uses, the fear of failure. You know, with the work things that I've done, other people haven't done it, because it's such a, in my industry, we're so risk averse that it's not even a case of, well, sometimes it's losing money. Sometimes to get in on the work, you've kind of got to do a certain amount of cut price work just to get it, to get the experience. They don't want to put the investment in, or why would they when there's loads of really decent paying work out there? So why would they do lower priced work to develop something? And the other part is, what about if they start something and it fails? Because everybody thinks, if I do it, the whole world's watching, and if I fail, everyone's going to think I'm a loser. As you know, I had something happen in my career which was at the time very, very embarrassing. And I mean, that's all done and dusted. And I was talking to some people in the profession about maybe a year ago. And I was talking about, you know, I said, I feel so embarrassed that this thing happened. And I assumed they'd know. And literally nobody in the profession even knew it had happened. Nobody knew.
Wow. So you actually kind of drew the attention, and no one actually knew anyway.
I mean, they were friends. But yeah, exactly. That's the point. Most of the time, the things that you try, if effectively you start it unless you're Elon Musk and you've launched the, you know, something in front of 4 billion people and then it doesn't go to market and you have to return some money. Most things you do and that you try, if it doesn't happen and it doesn't work out the way you want, you can quietly kill it.
And no one knows.
And nobody knows. And people will say, you know, and your friends and your family will probably just say, you made a decision at the right time, it's all good. But if you've hung on to it for too long, thinking, I can't possibly let this thing go, because if I let it go, I'm going to look like a moron. And it then again comes down to this point that you think, if people know that I've failed on this thing, they will reject me. They will think less of me. You know, they only like me, love me, want me because I'm successful and are this and are this. And it's just not true. It's just not true.
Yeah.
But we get used to that pattern of thinking that in order to be loved, liked, looked up to, all those kind of things, that we need to do all this stuff and we need to be perfect and we can't have any failures. And it comes back to your thing about being imperfectly perfect, or, you know, perfectly imperfect. You don't have to. People that you care about you because of you, and they certainly should. And all the things that you do on top of that are for you. So if you're not doing them for you, why are you doing them?
Exactly. And I think, you know, even kind of with the businesses that we did together, you know, and our business coach at the time when we had Would I Pee, we were looking at the bridal shop, and she actually turned around to us, didn't she? And she said, "I think you're making a mistake. I think you're going to end up with two mediocre businesses here, rather than actually, while your heads are together, you're going to have one incredible business." And I think I was a little bit headstrong in that, and we thought it was a great investment opportunity, and we were wrong, you know. And actually, walking away from that, you know, we had that for 3 years. Just after we split up, I closed that. But we can look at it as like, oh my God, I failed. But actually, you know,
You
failure
tried
is not
something.
even
No,
trying.
no. And the reality is, what would you have? I'm sure that even from that, you've had life experiences and you've learned skills and you've had to upskill in things that you wouldn't otherwise have had to do, that then bring success into other things.
100%. Well, I'd done a lot of things if we hadn't have done that, you know, and I'm sure you wouldn't have either.
No, and I think that's the thing. You know, you again. I can't remember who it was, but they were talking about, you know, entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial mindset, and this thing that effectively what a lot of them do is they'll try 20 businesses, 19 of them will fail, and one of the 19 will go, or of the 20 will skyrocket and will go, okay, I'm now going to put all of my money, my time into the one that's winning, and I'm just going to slowly let all the other ones fade into the background. And none of them inherently are, well, you know, none of them are actually failures. They're just ones that they're just attempts that weren't the optimal attempt.
And I suppose you deal with that a lot with your clients, don't you? Because you're dealing with companies, you know, some of your the clients that you work with, and you've worked with them since from being almost like tiny little companies to now being huge. You know, there's companies that I can think of that, you know, I don't know how whether you're open to mentioning them or not, you know, and you know, at
Yeah,
the end of
but
the day,
there are some where they've.
from that inception up. And a lot of the problems that, you know, you will say, and I've heard you say, is actually the problems come where people start something and they don't really realize that it's going to be something big. They don't put the agreements in place. They don't kind of do all of that due diligence. And then, you know, they get this almost like this company then is that's bigger, and they're like, oh, actually, one partner wants to get out of it or whatever, because suddenly this company is worth a lot of money. And they haven't ever thought it was ever going to be like that.
No, or they just, yeah, exactly. They haven't really thought about what happens if it's successful, what happens if it isn't successful. Years ago, when I was about 15, 16, I worked in a shop, and I remember one of the manager at the time said to me that when it comes to theft from the shop, about 20% comes from people off the street coming in and pilfering. About 25% of it is staff for the by the volume of what happened, you know, so the value of what was stolen. About 25% of it is staff who just take things out of the warehouse when no one's looking, and then 50% of the value of what gets stolen is management. It's the upper echelons, because when they steal less often, but when they steal, they take a lot. And so it's the same kind of in IP, the effective in intellectual property, that when you've built up a business. And I guess if you're in, say, if you're in the content industry, you set up a partnership with somebody, and you're marketing content, and you're doing workshops, and you're doing webinars and books and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay, there'll be some people who might, you know, read your content, what, you know, go to your webinars, and they might then copy some of it, and that might be one source of a problem, but it probably isn't that bad. You've then got, if you've employed some staff, they might, you know, learn some stuff along the way and go off and do something. I say junior staff, you know, inverted commas. The ones that you really, the person you really want to worry about is your business partner, because they know everything. They know where all the bodies are buried. They are the one who know how the business works. So if anybody was going to go and replicate and rip you off and completely kill you, it's your, you know, your key business partner, the other directors in the business, because they've got all the same contacts, they've got all those sort of things, so it'd be easy for them just to go, you know, move across, and then on day two just open credit lines and do all kinds of stuff and do their own thing. So
And you see that so often, don't you? And I think it's that position of when things are good, we don't worry about stuff. And actually, when it's gone south, that's when people kind of, you know, I suppose think, oh, why didn't we do this? Why didn't we do that? So I suppose as we're wrapping up, what would your top tips? I like to get people's top tips of, like, you know, they're in this position that they may be feeling like things aren't working how I would like them to work. Maybe they're judging themselves. Maybe because I know you've had to overcome a lot of those inner demons, those inner thoughts, to actually get to where you are now. What tips would you give to people to be able to move out their own way, to have the life that they really want to have?
Okay, that's a really tricky one. I think if everybody's got certain things that they, okay, so people know certain things that they're doing that are just not helping them. You know, you talk to somebody who, I mean, I was big, you know, I was big, I was overweight, and I was eating the wrong food. And I would, and I'd still do it. And you have to look at it and go, if you're acting irrationally, what is the irrational behavior doing for you that you, and you just have to sit there and work it out. And then work out, like for me, certainly with the weight loss, it was working out, what is it doing for me? When am I doing it? And how can I break that? So so for me, I felt stressed, so I was eating food because the chemical reaction was helping with stress, and there was stuff from my childhood around food and it being a way of showing love, so it was a way of showing myself love. And so you just go, okay, so there's two things there. There's getting rid of stress, showing yourself love, and I guess the third one for me was treating myself. And so you're just going to go, so how would I give myself those things in a way that doesn't compromise my goal of losing weight? And I just went, okay, so treating myself and helping stress. Given that I work in a business where I'm at my desk quite a lot, giving myself the gift of some time to go out for a walk, it got rid of the stress and it also made me feel good and it was a treat. So that would probably be number one. Number two is, I mean, we talk about modeling. I know in personal development, they talk about modeling. And I think that concept of working out somebody who has got the things that you want, or even the mindset. So again, okay, I'm going to go back to the weight loss thing. You kind of look and go, okay, well, look, who is my model? Or if I take on the view that I'm no longer, you know, I am an athlete, what would an athlete do in this situation? What's the behavior that they would do? And you should just change your mindset. I mean, I guess that's, you know, the shorthand way of putting it. And then I guess the third part is working out what's the emotional block that's stopping you from doing it. So, you know, if the relationship with somebody is not right, why are you not having that conversation? Is it because you think that they might reject you? And if they reject you, you know, that something is going to happen. I think it's the working out what's the worst that could happen if you start going on the path? Because there's something, even if you haven't consciously worked it out, there's something that your subconscious is stopping you for a reason. It's difficult, but those are definitely the three things that I think help me to solve almost anything.
I love that. And I think sometimes it can feel a lot more complicated than it really is. I think when we break it down into simple terms, it's actually far simpler than we think it is. I think the mind likes to make this big complicated thing, where simplicity is key, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Breaking it down into lots of little bits and then just working on each bit.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to be the first to know about new episodes. And in the meantime, check out our community at beingimperfectlyperfect.co.uk. We'll see you next time.